So far, I've presented all this as unproblematic. That language awareness, we need to raise it, it's important, language workers need it, blah, blah, blah. We can learn about what clients, you know, face. But do we, as applied linguists, want to get involved with language work or language workers? Should applied linguists do that? Do they perhaps have to in a climate of where impact in the real world counts for more and more? Because ultimately, we are contributing, and again, the we is very much shifting here, yeah, to the extent that applied linguists do that, they contribute to the commodification of language. Yeah. Now, Heller, Duchenne, and others have written about language as a commodity, and I think there's now, at least the people who are concerned about this, a consensus that in developed economies, we have, if you will, a perfect storm of the knowledge economy, a growing service sector, and saturated markets, which lead to, as Heller says, an increased importance for language in managing the flow of resources, providing symbolic added value to industrially produced resources. This is where brand tone of voice and these things come in. Facilitating the construction of and access to niche markets. So here Heller talks about language as identity, allegedly authentic identity. And developing linguistically mediated knowledge and service industries. And beyond that, I would say, and indeed language work, where language is not just the medium of work, but the object and the product of work. In a rare paper on critical language awareness in business communication, Winninger and Jen have said that in this climate, language is understood primarily as a means of communication, which fits well with the instrumentalism that characterizes mainstream management theory and practice. Linguistic instrumentalism, they call it, which sees the usefulness of language in terms of its economic value. So language is a commodity, it's bought and sold, crafted and designed. It's also a marketable skill. And there is a burgeoning discourse on language as a skill, communication as part of soft skills, etc., etc., with the main argument being numbers. Numbers, numbers, numbers. What does it cost the economy if people are short skilled? Yeah, so just two examples here, really. Yeah, how many million of dollars are at risk in project management due to ineffective communications? What about the loss of production because people have a soft skills deficit? How much does that cost our economy? So it's a rather alarmist discourse that operates with vast numbers and charts. Yeah? So this is an interview with UK employers who report on what skills they find lacking in applicants. You can see just over 40% oral communication skills, just underwritten communication skills, etc. So this is a call like, oh God, we need people with better communication skills. Yeah? That, at least in the UK, and I'm sure I know in other contexts as well, is usually a call to university, can you please produce these people with the right communication skills? And some applied linguists have answered that call. This was the abstract for a recent paper at the Sociolinguistics Symposium this last month, where the authors introduced their studies saying developing leadership and communication competencies should focus on promoting linguistic awareness in participants and enabling them to reflect on their own and others' linguistic contributions. And then they say, our approach is timely in addressing recent calls to promote reflection skills essential to enhancing employability. So reflection, language awareness, etc., has become a means to an economic end. I would now like to go back to the work of a previous generation of linguists at Lancaster. Critical views on education, critical literacy, critical language awareness, and all the rest of it. So, already in 1999, Norman Fairclough said, in a critical view of education, knowledge and skills are indeed taught and learned, but there are also questions. What counts as a skill and what doesn't? For whom? Why? What are the beneficial or problematic consequences? And he also pointed out that in passing on prestigious practices and values without developing a critical awareness of them, one is implicitly legitimizing them and the asymmetrical distribution of cultural capital. Now, these are harsh words. But I think, as far as I'm concerned anyway, they are no less true now than they were in 1992. Coming from a slightly different angle, Mautner has said that language awareness goes a long way towards alerting individuals, organizations, and social subsystems to infiltration by another dominant subsystem. He's here talking about the subsystem of business infiltrating higher education. And with remarkable confidence, she closes, and language awareness will help to immunize them against it. What we see from these quotes is that critical awareness is not just of language, but of text, discourse, practice around it, and the socioeconomic context level. So really what we're talking about is critical discourse awareness. Who needs this? If you look at the early literature on critical language education, it has traditionally been discussed with regards to underprivileged students, these days often referred to as widening participation students. But what if our students of the future need? Do they still need this? Well, the case has been made that yes, they do, and perhaps even more so than others. Educating future executives to be more critical of discourse practices must occur in tandem with raising language awareness within all echelons of the future workforce, but including future executives. Wallace even said that there's a greater need to educate white middle-class students in critical language study, which they may not otherwise feel much disposed to pursue, simply because their immediate interests are not at stake. And that's why, you know, we should focus efforts there as well. Yanks and Ivanich elaborate on this, saying mere awareness is not enough. Learners also need to find themselves ways of speaking and writing which impose less on the people they're speaking to. It's a rather interesting point they're making about emancipatory discourse, how that is not only a resistant discourse, well, it is, but it can also be done by people who are privileged. They can develop critical awareness of a discourse that doesn't disempower others or actively empowers them. But who wants it? Now, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that learner preferences on business communication courses do not include critical language awareness. Some of you are sniggering, so does that ring a bell? Yeah? Yeah? Good. Okay. So you do get these things. Well, why do we need this? Just tell us how to write a press release. You know, why do we need this? I came here to learn corporate communication, you know, not critical discourse studies or anything. Employers may wish for the benefit of this awareness, for fairer workplaces, better customer communication, increased reputation, etc. And I truly think that we have to decide on a case-by-case basis whether they want this for the profit motif or moral principles. I wouldn't rule out either. But whose wishes have priority? Is it really the priority of the employers and the learners alone? This is from 2008, Lancaster brochure, which uses the typical customer communications trope of you said you wanted, so we have done this. Yeah, so it's universities reacting to customer demand, i.e. student demand. In case you think, oh, well, that was 2008. Our library has just been refurbished. Very lovely now, but it has a big hoarding outside that says, you said, so we have. Okay. So, the question is that each and everyone needs to answer for themselves. Do we want to be ancillary to the skills demands by business? Or do we insist that our wishes as teachers for critical language awareness in our students also count for something? How much have I got left? How much time? Cut it a bit short then, but I do want to finish on critical language awareness and consulting. So very much speaking as a consulting person again, you know. Sometimes it's very easy to see how you could reconcile a critical language awareness with working in consulting where language is a commodity. So this is from a project for the NHS. I'll keep this very brief. This is an information leaflet to drive up vaccination rates in London. Was issued by what was then called a primary care trust in southeast London. Distributed in paper format about 7 years ago. Layout alone quite forbidding, quite old-fashioned. Lots of black and white box texts, blocks, etc. It's directed at parents in order, with the aim of making them have their children vaccinated because vaccination rates are very low. It has the typical question-answer format with the assumed audience voice and that answered. And in all fairness, it does try to include quasi-spoken features, such as it's much, much better to have the vaccination. And it engages in solidarity. So the safest way of protecting our children, etc. But this was a bit of data I worked with for this project for the NHS. In that you also find, more often than not, gems like this. Only if there is a confirmed anaphylactic reaction for air-containing food should pediatric advice be sought with a view to immunization under controlled conditions such as admission to hospital as a day case. So, I mean, this is a textbook worst practice example. Yeah. Technical jargon, abstract nominalizations, agent loops passives, they're all there. Also this, assumed audience voice by a parent, concerned parent. My child is allergic to egg. Can he have the vaccination? Does the fact that he has several allergies make it more likely he will experience side effects? Egg allergy is not a reason to either delay or not have the vaccination. Neither does the fact that your son has several allergies. That's who told. One thing we did as part of the project, my colleagues and I, we wrote this. So we would say things like, as a parent of a child with several allergies, you already have a lot to worry about. It's good news then that unless your child has had a severe reaction to egg-containing food before, the jab is totally safe. So do get in touch and we'll help you set up an appointment to get your child protected. You see what we're doing here, right? So we're stressing words like, you know, thereby concepts like safety, protection, etc. We do empathy, we acknowledge the concerns, we have a direct appeal to action, etc., etc. But you need to know what you're doing. Honestly, you do. You can't do this if you only know best practice examples or content. Good. So that may be obvious how that could be emancipatory, etc. Yeah? It's no problem reconciling that with critical language awareness. But what about private sector clients? Insurance companies, financial service providers, pharma companies, all of whom I've worked for. And then there was this one company where even after the project, and to this day, I still don't know what they actually do. Although I looked a lot at their internal discourse, I really cannot honestly tell you what they do. It was amazing. But anyway, is it enough if you have a critical conscience? Is it enough to make the company's external, sometimes also internal because there's a link, discourse less discriminatory, say less sexist, ageist, and generally condescending towards customers? Well, ultimately what you're doing, especially in the private sector, is to help clients increase revenue. You know, sometimes I think it's like trying to get a young child to eat their greens. You do something fatty, but you grate a bit of courgette in the hope that you can fool them. Sometimes I think it's a bit like that. Depends, of course, what your client is like. So, just to finish, here, this is Mautner talking about running communications training at, in fact, this university, so we're quite close to home here. And she talks about what she calls this dilemma. She said, linguists who help deliver such programs face quite a dilemma. On the one hand, it is because of their academic background and linguistic expertise that they are in a better position than many self-styled communications trainers to develop balanced and sound training modules, which avoid a grossly oversimplified transfer of customer orientation to higher education. On the other hand, it is this very background and expertise that makes linguists the most ardent critics of importing commercial concepts and discourses into academia. And then she concludes, the dilemma can be resolved by opting for a constructively critical approach, which puts language awareness center stage and shows trainees how linguistic resources can be employed to convey courtesy, empathy, and professionalism, without mimicking the customer service discourse of the commercial sector. Okay. But what about those of us who already work in the commercial sector, at least part of the time? Perhaps it is really about smuggling in the greens. And perhaps this is really, Jenks and Ivanov said, that critical language awareness helps people to conform with open eyes, occasionally, to identify their feelings about it, and to recognize the compromises they are making, but perhaps also to make some incremental change after all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Veronica, for an inspiring and, yes, thought-inspiring talk. And I think we have some time for questions, comments. Nothing left to say.
Or people are very hungry and waiting for lunch, I don't know.
Any questions or comments? Yes, Johanna?
Thank you. There has been some controversy surrounding the term language worker. So there was a publication by McGill, the linguistic journal, in the Journal of Linguistic Anthropology, whether it's a commodity or not. But I was wondering, as someone that is working on call centers, for example, I believe that's where originally the term came from. The term language worker, already worker has a blue-collar association, and also people might think of sex workers.
Yes, I've heard that point have been made, yeah.
Same in relation to language awareness. I've been thinking of, also as a call center researcher, is does it not obscure the very fact what people do and the skills they have? Because language is very, very broad in general, and it doesn't really say much. I mean, what skills do language workers have? I mean, what is language? Do they really all have the same skills? Is it not maybe literacy specialists, or I don't know, as a call center researcher, I would say I find it slightly problematic to lump everyone together and just call it language, instead of maybe raising awareness to the different skill sets.
Right, okay, yeah. About the point about the term language workers, I've heard that point before, and I agree, I'm not particularly wedded to the term. You could equally call them language professional, whatever it is, really. You know, it's a shorthand to be able to talk about this particular sector of the workforce. In terms of skill sets, I mean, I look at a very specific kind of language worker, right? So I looked at professionals, usually in consulting, specifically language and brand consulting, people who work in communications departments, et cetera, who obviously, need a specific language awareness, specific skills, which are different from people who do language work in other sectors of the economy, like call center workers, right? So, but as I said in the title, this was really about this specific type of language worker that I was interested in, not least because of my own dual position. And but that is not to say that there aren't specific awarenesses and skills that are needed for other people who work with language as the central object of their work.
What is language? How do you define language?
What is language?
Good question.
Where do you draw the line? I mean, why are some people language workers and why not others? I mean, that's why I think.
Right, okay, so the point is, with the initial definition, is that, I mean, practically everybody needs language to do their work, at least minimally, okay? So language is, like in any human endeavor, is the medium through which it is achieved. Yeah? But what I'm looking at here is people who not only use it as a medium, like, for instance, talking to patients or giving order to shop floor workers or what have you, right, but for people who work with language, yeah, textual artifacts spoken or written, yeah, as the object of their work. So who either analyze them, who analyze linguistic data from companies, or who produce particular training materials, language-based materials, etc. So that's the difference between people who use language as a medium and people who use language as the object of their work.
The perceived legitimacy of linguists in the corporate world linked to their ability to write incomprehensible language?
No, quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. So in order to even start the conversation, in the corporate world, that you need to do this translanguaging. Yeah, and I've made the case of why is this even important. So first of all, to point out that language is involved, yeah, and I've had a couple of quotes. Of course, you need to show your credentials. You need to say that you have your linguistic ability, that you have published, etc., etc. So you need to be credible. You don't need to be what Gerlinde Mautner calls a self-styled communications trainer. Yeah, so you need to show your credentials, but on top of your academic credentials, you need to be able to translanguage.
I'm talking about Linguistic Landscape, the consulting agency. Mm-hmm. So that started way back, I guess. The question is, the clients, you worked on their way of producing language, on the way of presenting themselves. Mm-hmm. Has anyone ever gone back to see whether something's changed in their everyday practice? Since
yes.
That their social practice, linguistic practice, consume one another.
Yes. So not in every case, but with long-term clients in particular, where you do a string of projects over the years. And with one client, a charity, a cancer charity, nonetheless, that's quite interesting for me. They had a brand relaunch. I mean, they really talked that language, even though a charity, in order to reach more people who they felt needed their help and who they weren't reaching because of how they sounded. So they did a complete brand change, including a name change, and we worked at the linguistic end of that, brand tone of voice. And a year later, they asked us if we could go into the company and listen to their helpline calls, look at their materials that they'd prepared, whether we could say that they are actually using the new brand tone of voice. So that does happen, yes. And they did, so, which was just great to see, yeah.
Okay, maybe just one more, Mia?
Thank you for a very amazing talk, and I particularly appreciate the dual perspective of academic and practitioner. And I was wondering, you have mentioned it several times, but in your opinion, as both an academic and a practitioner, what is the most important thing that we need to be teaching to our students as business communication experts to do?
How language works. How some sort of, you know, basic linguistic training about what it is that you're doing, you know, and what effect does it have? What is an agentless passive? We don't need to phrase it as such, but compare these senses. What, not only what effects does it have, but how are they different? And give them some basic toolkit about how to not only recognize an effect, but also recognize how that effect was achieved. Because I think only then can you actually use language productively. Otherwise, you'll be forever stuck in repeating stock phrases.
Okay, I think we just, are there any more announcements? No? So just to say, lunch is the same place as yesterday, and you need your voucher. And I'd like to thank Veronica again for her inspiring talk.